It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, our guest is worried that proposed food safety regulations would hurt small farmers and sustainable agriculture.
First, when does unhappiness cross the line into depression? And are there ways to deal with unhappiness that isn't severe enough to need medication?
Our guest tackles those questions in her new book. Shelley Carson is a research psychologist at Harvard University, co-author of Almost Depressed, Is My or My Loved One's Unhappiness a Problem? Shelley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob, for inviting me.
So what does it mean to be almost depressed?
Well, almost depressed is a spectrum of mood problems that aren't severe enough to actually be diagnosed as a major depressive disorder, but they're nevertheless interfering with you or someone you care about's ability to savor life or carry out responsibilities at your optimum capacity. So if you think about depression as existing on a continuum with normal ups and downs of mood at one extreme end and full-blown depressive disorder at the other end, then the area that we call almost depressed is that gray space in between. It's not a mental disorder, and you're not incapacitated by it, but you're still not operating at full speed.
And how many of these people who are almost depressed slide into the area of actual depression?
So that's one of the big reasons why we want to emphasize that people should be looking out for almost depressed symptoms. Research shows us that about 75% of people with subclinical symptoms of depression eventually will experience a full-blown depressive episode. And that's very dangerous because people with depression are at 4 times greater risk for heart problems, and they're at between 9 and 15 times greater risk for suicide.
Now, what are some of the symptoms we should be watching out for to know if we're almost depressed, if we're in this continuum?
One of the first things that people should look for is, are you starting to back away from your social engagement? Are you starting to find excuses not to go out with your friends or spend time with family? So this is a symptom of social isolation, which can be a real good indicator that somebody's beginning to feel almost depressed. Another symptom is if things that used to be a lot of fun for you just don't seem like as much fun anymore, or if you're a lot more irritable for a long period of time than you used to be. And finally, if you just feel like you're in a state of the blues or a down state that you just don't seem to be able to kick, these would be signs of almost depression. Oh, and one more that I forgot to mention is if you feel like you're chronically overstressed over a long period of time, this could be a symptom as well.
And how long would these periods last before you sort of sit up and say, yeah, I guess I should start looking at things to do to make myself feel better?
Well, with low-grade depressive symptoms, people can be suffering for months because sometimes the symptoms don't come on right away. You just kind of gradually back into them. And you may not even realize that, hey, the days aren't as happy as they used to be. So I would say, This is one of the reasons that we like to get loved ones involved and have everybody keep an eye on each other, because lots of times people who are almost depressed don't realize it for months.
I wanted to ask you about that. If you're seeing these things in a loved one, what's a way to open up that conversation and see if they maybe want to do something about this?
Well, one of the things that I would suggest people say is, gee, you don't seem to be yourself these days. Is something the matter or is something bothering you? That would be one way to enter into the conversation. One of the ways we don't suggest is that you tell people to snap out of it or cheer up because there's nothing to be unhappy about. That usually doesn't work and just tends to irritate people even more. But when you let people know that you're concerned about them and that you've noticed a change in their demeanor or a change in their personality, and that you'd like to help them get to the bottom of it, then people are usually more responsive.
Well, let's get to some of the things that we can do, constructive things. If we've noticed that we're in one of these slumps, we don't want it to slide into something more serious. What's sort of step one toward being healthier and feeling better?
Well, what's really interesting is that when we talk about depression and the whole spectrum of depressive symptoms, There are so many different causes for depression, and they can be biological, psychological, or social in nature. And consequently, there are biological, psychological, and social steps that you can actually take to get out, to feel better. So depression can develop very slowly. And as I said, you can have mild symptoms for years before they become full-blown. But if you can recognize them early, before they become fully developed, you can take some simple actions. And one of the first things that we recommend is make sure you're getting enough exercise. Very busy people, people who are overstressed, will say they just don't have time for exercise. And we've heard every excuse in the book. But the fact of the matter is this. When you physically get your exercise, you are oxygenating your brain. And this is going to actually have an effect on the neurochemicals that produce moods. So it's very important to get exercise. And we recommend at least 3 times a week getting at least 30 minutes of aerobic exercise, plus a little warm-up and cool-down period.
Well, that's kind of a challenge because part of the depression continuum here is you don't want to do stuff. It's hard to maybe get motivated. Is it maybe a taller hurdle than it sounds like even to get a little bit of exercise?
Well, certainly people come up with all kinds of excuses for it. But one of the things that we recommend is that if you feel like you really can't take steps on your own, then you may be more seriously depressed than you think, and you ought to try to get some help from a mental health professional. But usually, just realizing, oh, okay, yes, I am starting to feel some of these symptoms, will motivate people to want to do something about it. And I certainly am one to agree that it's very difficult to fit the exercise in there, but exercise is one of the most natural antidepressants that we have. So I recommend that people start with that. A second thing that people can do is just make sure that you're not constantly just getting through your day and taking care of your work, but try to engage in activities that you find pleasant as well. Try to fit some of those activities into your weekly calendar.
So take care to make sure that there are some things that are bringing you happiness and joy besides just, you know, taking out the laundry or the garbage and doing the laundry.
That's true. And one of the things people can do is even if they don't feel like things are very much fun for them right now, if you write down a list of things that you used to find fun and try to plug a few of those into your calendar, that can be very beneficial. So one of the things you want to make sure is that you're not isolating yourself and you're not staying inside all the time, that you're getting yourself out there. There are other steps that you can also take. One of the ways that I like to tell people to improve their mood is because creativity is one of my areas of research interest. People can express themselves in creative ways and kind of channel that negative energy into creative work. You don't have to be talented to do this. If you just sit down and write out how you're feeling or get a canvas or just a piece of paper and some paint and slap the paint on and make the paint express how you're feeling at the moment, this creative act is very beneficial in increasing your mood.
I thought that was really interesting to see that. And have you seen that in people? Have you seen examples of people harnessing their creativity to come out of unhappiness?
Absolutely. People use it all the time. So I do a lot of consulting with creative people, and this is the way that they regulate their mood. They regulate their emotions by doing creative work.
We're talking to Shelley Carson. She's a research psychologist. She's co-author of the book Almost Depressed.
And we want to hear from you. What advice do you have on how to deal with depression, unhappiness? Maybe you've pulled yourself out of a slide. What techniques did you use to kind of turn things around? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Harvard research psychologist Shelley Carson. She's the co-author of the book Almost Depressed.
And we want to hear from you. When you're unhappy, is there something that you do that you rely on to get yourself out of that slide? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Well, Shelley, we've talked some about exercise, about creativity. One thing that I thought was interesting on the psychological side of things was confronting depressive thoughts and reframing them. Can you talk about that a little?
Right. So all of us have a running stream of commentary going through our brains, just a constant verbal thought that we call self-talk. And lots of people don't even listen to what it is they're saying to themselves. But if you stop and listen to the words you're saying to yourself after, for instance, after something negative happens, are you saying things like, oh, you're so stupid, you've done it again, you've messed it up again, you never do anything right, these things always happen to you? If you're saying things like that to yourself, then that is negative self-talk. And we also call that your inner critic. Well, if you let your inner critic take charge of you, you are going to feel very low as far as your mood goes. So one of the things that we suggest is that you actually start monitoring your inner critic or monitoring your self-talk and listen for patterns of negativity that you might find there. Once you find negative thoughts, the goal is to replace them with more positive but realistic thoughts. So you don't want to just be Pollyanna, oh, everything's going to be fine, everything's going to be okay. But what you do want to do is realistically assess things that are going on in your life and then try to decide what would be the best outcome from here and have confidence that you can work toward that outcome. So replacing negative self-talk or your inner critic with positive but realistic self-talk is another way to help yourself feel better. One other thing I wanted to mention is stress. Stress in and of itself isn't a bad thing. We all need a certain amount of stress to motivate us and keep us fulfilled. But when stress becomes overbearing, when you're dealing with either one item of stress that's just too much for you, or more often what happens is that a whole bunch of little stressors will accumulate and you become overstressed, then you just want to yell, stop the world, I want to get off, and you're feeling almost depressed. So I would recommend that people use a stress thermometer. Try to figure out what level of stress feels good to you, and then every once in a while stop and take a stress check. Am I feeling overstressed now? And the overstress that I'm feeling, is it something that's going to resolve soon, or am I just living with this day after day?
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's take a phone call now. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We have Greg on the line from Eau Claire. Hi, Greg. Greg, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry. My phone was giving me trouble.
Sure.
Yes, first, I'd like to second one of the things the guest just commented on.
Oh, no. Your phone, Greg. I'm sorry. I think Greg was going to speak to something about the importance of sort of losing yourself in things that you enjoy, I'm assuming. What about that?
Well, definitely losing yourself in something you enjoy, which is sometimes called flow or being in the zone, is a wonderful way to relieve feelings of depression. And one of the ways to do that, going back to stress, is finding things to do that are challenging, but that you feel up to the challenge. So things become stressful and anxiety-provoking when you perceive that you cannot deal with the stress. If you perceive you can deal with it, then threats become a challenge, and dealing with challenges can often lead to a state of flow. So that's a very good, if that was what Greg was going to say, well done, Greg.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Greg. Sorry to lose your call.
We'll go to Brandon in Racine now. Brandon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to ask about?
Well, I guess I was wondering if your guest finds any, as long as a person is manages it correctly and doesn't let it get to that depressive state. Do you find that there is any kind of value in sadness? I feel like we've kind of set up this dichotomy between sadness and happiness, or positive and negative, and that negative is always bad and positive is always good. We're so success oriented in this culture, and we're so goal driven in this culture that sometimes sadness just happens, I think, you know, because of that. And I think there's some value in that, and there's some value in deepening a person emotionally.
Interesting. Thanks, Brandon. Shelley, what do you make of that?
I think that's a wonderful point, Brandon. A normal emotion has typical ebbs and flows. It's not healthy to feel happy all the time, because sadness is a response to loss. And we can't get through our lives without having losses, major ones, minor ones, and sadness is a result of that, and it's natural and normal to feel sad after a loss. So to try to artificially uplift yourself during a period of sadness isn't necessarily a healthy thing. What's unhealthy, though, is when the sadness lingers longer than one would expect it to after a loss. But I definitely agree with Brandon that sadness and happiness juxtaposed are what makes our emotional lives rich. So definitely there is a place for sadness in our lives.
I want to talk to you about something that's been getting a lot of attention lately. A lot of people are talking about it. There's a growing body of research around meditation and how that might help regulate moods as well. What do you know about meditation and depression?
Well, in fact, we have two chapters that are devoted to mindfulness meditation in our book. And mindfulness meditation in particular is a very good way to deal with worry and rumination, both of which are associated with depressive symptoms. Mindfulness meditation allows you to live in the moment and to observe yourself and your surroundings non-judgmentally. So you are just being in the moment without judging it. And it takes practice and it takes dedication, but once you have mastered this, even to a minor extent, you don't have to be a master meditator in order to get the benefit from it. But learning how to meditate is very beneficial.
We have time for one more caller. Dan is with us in Madison. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. One of the things that you asked earlier is how people might consider dealing with depression, and this may not be good for deep depression, but one of the things that I find and a lot of friends find is just being outside in nature. There's something in our genes that connects us intrinsically with nature. There are a lot of groups that actually are looking for volunteers that could be helping. You could be working on restoration projects or just be out hiking. Some people like to be busy with their hands, and you can have a feeling of accomplishment. A little story I'll share is I was out hiking in an area I take care of and ran into a very nice woman, and we were talking, and she indicated that she was a geriatric doctor and had to come out because she had some stresses and losses in her profession.
Great. Thanks a lot, Dan. So getting out in nature, Shelley.
We recommend that in our book as well. That's a wonderful point, Dan. Being out in nature and being connected with the world is definitely an antidote for depression. And it's also very good for your creativity as well, I might add. So thank you, Dan, for that call.
Well, thank you much for that, Dan. And, you know, in the last moments here, what do you think about maybe one or two simple tips that someone could start right now if they're feeling depressed?
Well, the first thing, of course, is to make sure you're getting exercise. And if you can exercise outdoors, that's a wonderful thing. A second thing that you might want to check on is your vitamin D level. Vitamin D is associated, lack of vitamin D is associated with depression. And a lot of Americans are suffering from vitamin D deficits, We're also suffering from omega-3 fatty acid deficits, and omega-3 fatty acids have cellular effects on the neurotransmitters in our brain that are associated with mood. So two things I would recommend for people that are very easy to do is get your vitamin D checked and start taking an omega-3 fatty acid supplement. Go online and see which ones are the highest quality. And that's something very easy you can do to help your mood.
All right. Shelley, we're all out of time. Thanks for joining us today. That was Shelley Carson, Harvard research psychologist and co-author of Almost Depressed.
Coming up, a look at proposed food safety regulations. Our guest is worried about the impact they could have on sustainable agriculture in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The FDA is currently taking comments over the next week on rules that will implement the new Food Modernization and Safety Act.
Our guest today says the FDA's draft regulations could hurt some of the country's small-scale local growers.
Joining us to talk about that issue is Mark Estelle, co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute, a populist farm policy research group based in Wisconsin, and director of its Organic Integrity Project. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Congratulations on your new show. I think
it's
great.
Thank you. Well, let's start with a primer on what these new food regulations will involve.
Well, there, for some time, and I mean years, it's been obvious that large corporate agribusinesses, through neglect, have been literally poisoning the citizenry. We've had repeated major nationwide food contamination problems that have sickened and sadly killed many. And this really came to a head with a couple major incidents, the big spinach E. coli contamination problem from California a few years ago. There was a quite widespread problem with contaminated peanut products from Peanut Corporation of America, kind of literally a rat-infested facility. And so Congress finally stepped in and said, look, we got to do something more comprehensive. And we support that. Unfortunately, they've written these rules from such a global standpoint that instead of just looking at these major industrial scale agricultural businesses and imports, which are of really questionable value and quality.
All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of the nuts and bolts. What are some that you're most concerned about?
Well, two major points. One is that they're not really looking at the root cause of why our vegetables, in this case, and fruits are becoming contaminated. There's nothing inherently dangerous, as an example, about spinach. First, you need to put manure on it, and it can't be run-of-the-mill manure. It has to come out of one of these large CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, or factory farms, and from really sick animals. So somehow it's getting in the water, it's getting in surface and groundwater, it's getting in the air, it's being spread by manure being used as fertilizer. And the sad part about this FDA new rulemaking, even though Congress wanted them and they did collaborate with the USDA that has jurisdiction over these industrial livestock facilities, there's nothing in there to address the contamination. The other major flaw is that they're treating all vegetables the same. We know that the bagged greens, the spinach and pre-washed lettuces, are especially, because of their long shelf life, because of the way they're processed, especially vulnerable to contamination. They're treating other vegetables, unlike the bagged products that have had numerous contamination incidents, the same way. So something like a bulb onion that might be produced in the southeast part of the United States is treated just like bagged spinach from California, even though, to my knowledge, there's never been a contamination problem with onions. So it causes the farmers to spend, in aggregate, millions, and then our tax dollars, the limited resources we have to oversee these businesses, are being not directed at the greatest risk.
Now, it sounds like small and beginning farmers are particularly concerned about complying with some of these rules and how much it might take off their profit margin. How would you describe the concerns that they have?
Well, I would describe them as being legitimate. So these large industrial-scale operations in California, most of them already have a quality control staff. They have laboratories to do their own testing. In a state like Wisconsin, where we have a budding movement for local foods, we have one of the most preeminent farmers markets in the country and around the Capitol Square in Madison. We have lots of CSA, community-supported agriculture farms, where consumers buy a share at the beginning of the season. These are the farmers that are really going to have the screws turned on them. In some cases, they have to test water that they're using for irrigation on a weekly basis, even though there's no evidence of contamination. The record keeping will be very expensive, and these are family-scale farms where labor, you're already talking about farmers literally working 16-hour days in the season. Where is that time, let alone money, going to come from?
Now, Mother Jones has said, you know, to name a few examples of what the law could eliminate, the organic kids, organic carrots in your kids' school lunch program, the kohlrabi in your farm share box, the pickles peddled by your favorite hipster farmer. You know, that might be an extreme view of what could happen, but do you think that the trade-off of food safety is worth some of those things?
Not this version of food safety. I can tell you that I was a fresh market certified organic vegetable producer about 20 years ago, and we had probably the most efficient food safety protocol that would be the envy of these large outfits. And that is, what we were harvesting in the cool dew of the morning was on the lunch table at noon for our family and crew. And if there was a problem, we'd know about it right away. If it was an organism that required incubation, instead of that taking place in a quality control laboratory in a petri dish, it was taking place in our gut. We never had a food contamination problem. But if we did, we know our customers, it would be on a scale akin to Aunt Tilly's egg salad being left out too long at the church picnic, not in all 50 states like the spinach problem. So we're really talking about jeopardizing probably the safest farms, owner-operated, hands-on, owner-managed. And do you want to compare that to where they're buying from Mexico, California? We really don't know where it's all coming from. In many cases, these tracebacks take months to accomplish before they're really able to ascertain where the contamination came from.
Now, it sounds like there may be some exemptions for farms making sales less than $500,000. Would that address some of your concerns about this affecting these smaller farmers?
It would if it was implemented properly. Unfortunately, Congress exempted a direct marketer, so local farmstead CSA farmers, under $500,000. But the problem is they built no due process into the regulations. So they could come to a farmer in the height of the season, again, working 16 hours a day, and say, instantly, we need you to implement all these testing protocols that you were exempt from. Farmers won't be able to do that. So we need some fairness built in here to accomplish that exemption. And I hope you will give our website out at the end. We really desperately need consumers, or the customers of the farmers, to chime in to the FDA to make their voices heard, because this really will jeopardize their access to food.
Now, there is a lot of fear around food. I mean, I guess when we see these big contamination cases, it usually seems when they're national like that, that means they've come from a large operation that distributes nationally. But there is fear, and it needs to be addressed. How would you suggest addressing some of the fear about contamination around food, if not this way?
Well, ultimately, the best thing to do is to know your farmer. And the pinnacle there is to grow it in your own garden. But when you go to the farmer's market, or you go to the Willie Street Food Co-op in Madison, or the Stevens Point Food Co-op, or Viroqua, or People's Food Co-op in La Crosse, that's like a farmer's market 7 days a week. They vet their farmers. They know their farmers. They're local. I think that gives us a level of security. I know it does for me, because I buy a lot of my own food these days, that is not an anonymous brand name, corporate-owned operation. But the bottom line is we do need the FDA to do a judicious job of overseeing how our food is produced. It's just we don't want them to pick on the safest farmers, and we want the resources to be applied proportionally to where the risk is.
Now, in terms of calling, you know, these smaller scale organic outfits the safest, is there a body of research to back that up? I've heard other guests in the past say that, you know, you can get an E. coli outbreak at your local farmer's market, you know the farmer's name, just as well as you can get it at a large scale factory farm. Is it really true that these small operations are safer?
Well, that is basically anecdotal. There has been no research that I know of comparing them. But when we track the reported incidents at the FDA, they're not coming from these small farms. The guest who told you that there is risk in all the food, if we're talking about fresh food, food that we're not heating up, that so like lettuce, there is some degree of risk because we're dealing with nature. But we can mitigate those risks by proper handling and proper manure handling in terms of fertilization. And really, again, it really boils down to, are you growing vegetables where the irrigation water or the packing shed water might be influenced by a factory farm raising livestock, and that's where the greatest risks are.
Now, the FDA is taking feedback on these rules through, I think it is November 15th. How can people give their feedback?
That's correct. Well, I think the easiest way to do that right now, and it's a little self-serving to say so, they can either go to government.org or they can go to the Cornucopia website, and we'll include some talking points. And right now we have a proxy that they can download and mail in, and we'll hand carry it to the FDA. They would have to do that pretty much right away if they want theirs to go in. Otherwise, they should go directly to government.org, I think it is. It's on our website. So if you go to cornucopia.org, C-O-R-N-U-C-O-P-I-A, and click on Action Alerts, you'll get a complete briefing.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
That was Mark Costell, co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute. And we'll have that link to Cornucopia Institute's website on our Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Food Friday time now. Baking a loaf of bread from scratch might be a great way to relax this November weekend.
So we've got our bread baking ninja with us now. Ian Knauer is the host of the new PBS series called The Farm, and he's got a cookbook out by that same name. He also teaches bread baking at the Culinary Loft in New York. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me. Nobody's ever called me a bread baking ninja. I love that.
We debated about that, and we thought, you know what? Ian qualifies as a ninja.
Oh, yeah.
I have a black belt in yeast rising.
Well, let's talk about that yeast rising. I mean, a lot of us love freshly baked bread. I'm one of them. But when I bake it, it tends to come out like a bloated year-old fruitcake in texture, which is not exactly what I'm going for. Can anyone learn to make bread?
Anyone can learn to make bread. It is one of the most feared and also easiest things to make in your home kitchen. And I used to be afraid of it, too. I think it's really common because every time you try it, it somehow turns out different. You can't figure out why. Is that the problem?
Definitely. And I fear it, too, having tried it a couple times in the past. So what's the biggest mistake people make when they first start making bread?
The biggest mistake is not thinking that you're in charge. In other words, you're basically living in the yeast's world, and you have to learn to understand what the yeast wants and what it's doing, and you have to read the signs. You have to be a good listener to bake bread. And so if you think you're in charge, that's mistake number one. Now, the way that you can work with that is you can realize the function of the yeast, because the yeast is this living organism that is basically feeding off the sugars and protein that are in the bread, in the flour. And they like certain conditions. So they like it when it's warm. They like it when it's moist. And if you supply them with those conditions, then they're going to behave better. They'll be happy, in other words, and they'll rise in the time that you want them to rise, and they'll give you the nice air bubbles that you want, and they'll give you the flavor that you want, too.
Now, you can buy the yeast from the store, which is how I've often done it, how I've always done it, actually. But I've also heard that you can simply use the yeast in the air somehow to make a starter.
What?
Is that advanced?
It's not that advanced. It's pretty easy. And you're right. The air is full of living things, full of bacteria. We breathe them with every breath. And some of those bacteria are really good for baking bread. Now, the special thing about your own starter, which is what you would make sourdough from, is that anywhere you are is going to be different than anywhere else. So San Francisco, for instance, is famous for their sourdough because they have certain bugs in the air that taste really sour when they are used to leaven bread. Now, the way to do this, there are a couple different ways to do this. Some people like to use grapes. So grapes have a yeast on their skin. It's called a bloom. You can actually see it. Apples have it, too. If you get apples that haven't been sprayed, they have a little film on the outside, and that is a natural yeast.
That's that white film?
Exactly. That's why you don't need to add yeast if you're making wine. You just crush the grapes, and the natural yeast that's on the skins will ferment it. So there's a natural yeast on there, and we know from, you know, thousands of years of history that that yeast translates into good bread yeast. So you can take some grapes, you can mash them up and make like a paste with some flour and then let that sit at room temperature for about 24 hours, and it will start to, those yeast in the grapes will start to eat the proteins in the flour. And then you can, you know, take all your grape skins out and add some water, make it into a thinner paste, and then sort of get all the solids out. And then that's a starter. Now, another way to do it, and the way that I like to do it, is with honey, because I keep honeybees, so I have a lot of honey lying around. So I make a crude sort of paste with flour and a little bit of honey and some warm water, and I let that sit at room temperature for about 24 hours. And sure enough, in 24 hours, those natural yeast in the air start to move in, and they like the sugar that's in the honey. Honey also has a lot of minerals in it, which is good for the yeast. And then they start to set in and make a home in that flour. Now, if you want to bake with that and use it as your yeast, you need to keep it alive. So that yeast is eventually going to run out of food. So you need to take some of the, basically cut half of it out and use that to bake your bread, and then add some more flour and water. So you keep feeding that yeast and keep going. You can keep your sourdough alive for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wow.
Wow.
I think you just blew Rob's mind.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I knew none of this. This is cool stuff. Well, all right, so we've got our yeast, whether we made it ourselves or bought that little packet at the store, and we're into the kneading stage. Let's jump up to there. Any kneading advice to get the bread the way we want it?
Yes. Well, let's start with the rest of the ingredients. So we have the yeast, we have the flour, of course, mm-hmm. we have water, and we have salt. And each one of these things has a function. So the yeast makes little bubbles of carbon dioxide that give you the holes in the bread. And the flour has gluten in it. You know, gluten is like, it's a bad word these days, but it's absolutely necessary when you're making bread. And what that gluten does is it stretches and becomes stringy. And as you knead it, you what's called activate, you activate the gluten. And those proteins wake up, and they hold the bubbles in the bread. So without the glutens, it would just bubble away, and it would look like a soda, and all that carbon dioxide would go out into the air. But with those glutens, they trap the air inside, which is what happens when the bread is rising. So you need those glutens, and then you have your water, of course, which helps mix everything together, but it also helps steam from the inside out, and that's very important because steam is what gives you a crispy crust. And then, of course, the salt helps you taste it, and it also slows down the yeast a little bit so the yeast doesn't go too crazy. So all those four ingredients are important, but again, it's only four ingredients, and you have an infinite number of breads with those four ingredients.
Well, we just posted a recipe that you gave us for your favorite baguette basic bread recipe. Tell us a little bit about that recipe that's up on our Facebook page now.
So that recipe, I learned this technique from a French baker named Richard Bertinet. He has a baking school in England, actually. And I took a week of classes with him because I was afraid of baking and I wanted to learn how to do it, so I went to the expert. And this is based on his dough. It's a little bit different, but it's mostly the same. Now, he uses a much higher proportion of water to flour than what most bakers, at least in this country, are used to seeing. So when his dough comes together, or when this dough comes together that you just posted on the website, it seems really wet to a lot of people, and that makes them nervous, of course, because it's very sticky. But what you end up with, because there's more water in there proportionately, is a super crispy crust, just like a baguette or, you know, another European-style bakery loaf. And when you cook this, even in your home oven, you don't need a special oven for this. You will get literally a bakery quality baguette at home. It's the most incredible thing. It impresses everybody who makes it and tastes it.
And that's the point of baking, after all.
Right, is to make people happy,
right.
Including yourself.
All right, the bread is made. What's your favorite way to eat it, Ian?
Well, again, you know, I mean, it depends on how fresh the bread is. So here's something that I learned that is actually a really important tip. When you're baking bread, you want to let the bread cool completely before you cut into it or break into it. And we're all guilty of this. You know, you get excited and you think, oh, warm bread is great. And warm bread is great, but rewarmed bread is great. What happens when you cut into it, that bread is still cooking, still baking until it's cooled to room temperature, because all that moisture that's trapped inside is steaming it from the inside out. And when you cut into it, you let all that out, and what you end up with is sort of like a gloppy, really gooey center of your bread. So you want to wait till it cools completely, and then if you like warm bread, warm it up again. And that's the way to eat warm bread.
That's a great tip to leave us with, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
That's Ian Knauer, host of a new PBS series called The Farm. He's got a cookbook out by the same name.